When you think about morally fraught historical events, there can be a compulsion to wonder, what would I have done in those circumstances? How would I have reacted? World War II fiction is rife with opportunities to reflect on how ordinary people respond to extraordinary situations, to protect their loved ones, and for their own survival. Vermont writer Stephen Kiernan's new novel is The Baker's Secret. The baker is a young woman named Emma, whose village sits on the Normandy coast of France. The story unspools Emma's transformation from a normal teenager to a cunning but desperate survivor of German occupation, who finds a way to help her neighbors survive as well. Stephen Kiernan, thank you so much for joining us.
Delighted to be here.
Describe the heroine of The Baker's Secret, Emmanuelle.
Well, she has quite an arc in the course of this book, but she starts out as a kind of prodigy baker, and she's apprenticed to the main baker in this small town in northern France. Her mother died years ago, so she lives with her father and her grandmother, who is very, very stubborn, and she has inherited some of her grandmother's stubbornness. And she's very good at baking, and she has a sweetheart, and she has a kind of inconsequential life until the Germans take control of France, at which point her life changes dramatically. And she finds herself, she's the person everyone comes to who's in need, and she doesn't understand it, but she grows into the job, and she soon becomes the hub of a network of kind of clandestine barter and exchange, and she turns out to be that web is what keeps the community alive, and she does this with all her heart. And even when the battle is imminent and things are really dire and she's in bad physical shape because of things that have been done to her, she still persists in this, and it becomes sort of her reason for being. She's also, it's important to say, someone who does not have any faith that the Allies will ever come, that redemption will ever occur. Life under the Third Reich is going to be the only life that she knows. So it's really about how to help one another survive in that new world.
And you mentioned this really complicated barter network that she develops. And her entry point to that is that early in the novel, we learn that the German officers are giving her an extra portion of flour so that she will make bread for them.
Yes, it's not much of a gift. They're requiring her to make 12 baguettes a day. But she discovers that if she grinds up straw very, very, very fine and adds some salt to the dough, that she can make 14 loaves. And those two extra loaves are not just something that she can share among her hungry neighbors, but they're also like the beginning of a currency, and they're something that then she can trade with this person for eggs and that person for tobacco and this person for fuel. And she becomes sort of the exchange mechanism, and everyone is unknown to everyone else. They don't know how she does it. They just know that when someone's got a bad leg, she shows up with a cane. And how she did that and what deals she made are really something only she knows, so that no one can get in trouble if she's ever found out. And when the book begins, it is the morning of the day before D-Day. And in the course of that day, there is a Nazi captain who finds out everything that she's doing. And she's very much revealed, so that as D-Day dawns, she is supposed to be executed at dawn.
You already revealed much more of the plot than I thought you were willing to.
Have I just spoiled my own?
Well, you haven't spoiled it, because the read is enjoyable every step of the way. We know at the beginning of the book that it's June 5th, so we know from history what is about to happen. What we don't know is what Emma's fate will be as the day unfolds.
And all of the villagers, yes.
And through flashbacks, we learn about what has transpired in the previous years in that village and what has happened to the people that Emma loves and cares about. That really drives her. It's her motivation for her actions throughout the story.
You know, one of the challenges in this time is how people will behave when they have kind of an ultimate authority that is presented with them. I would not do well in this circumstance. I'm not very good with authority, especially if it's not authority I respect. So I would not survive in this world. But Emma is determined to survive. And so she has to do something very difficult, which is to maintain her internal dignity so that she appears obedient while she's actually pursuing exactly what's meaningful to her. Because I feel that some of the ways that these people struggle to survive actually is universal human behavior and is about human will and dignity. And so you won't see the word Nazi or Germany or France in this book at all. You won't see the names of divisions or battalions or anything else. Because I believe that during the siege of Leningrad, there was someone like Emma who was taking care of her fellow people that were stuck in that siege. And I want to believe very much that today in Aleppo, there is someone like Emma that is helping people survive in those horrible circumstances.
I want to ask you to read a passage that explains some of the pressure that Emma is under. I mean, self-imposed, she's put herself in the position of providing for her neighbors, but she, at one point in the book, is in a very desperate situation, and she's contemplating what will happen if she doesn't make it.
Yes, she's in a bad spot at this moment. A jolt of pain startled Emma awake. She sucked air, gasped, felt her lungs inflate as though she had exhaled hours ago, and it brought a sharp stab to all of her left side ribs. Emmanuel was not finished yet. With her second breath came worry. If she died, who would care for Meme, putting up with her stubbornness and calming her with tenderness? Who would straw the dough to make extra loaves? Who would bring Michelle her egg, and Yves his fuel, and Pierre his tobacco, and more eggs to Fleur and her damaged mother Marie, on and on, Odette, the priest, and Monkey Boy? No one. If you want to know your worth in this world, make a list of the people who will starve when you die.
And in her case, starvation is a pretty literal risk for her and her neighbors.
Absolutely. They're under very strict rations, and even those aren't normally made available to them. And many people are starving to death at this time. In my research from the time, people were eating wallpaper because the glue behind it had some protein in it because it was made from horses. And so literally people would eat the plaster of their walls. That's how hungry they were. Pretty dire times.
Pretty dire. And a lot of her barter network relies on stealing from the soldiers in order to add currency to the network to get the fishermen enough fuel to go out to sea, to get fish, to bring back, to feed the rest of the village. It's not a network of selfishness, but she's very careful about who she trusts to be part of the network.
Well, in fact, it's the opposite. It's a network in which she often doesn't leave enough to feed herself. Here's a point I think it's important to make, though. Although this is a war novel and these people in very dire circumstances, and there are some dark moments, it's not a battle novel, and it's actually not a depressing novel. Actually, how these people outsmart their circumstances has a kind of triumph to it, has a strength to it. And sometimes just something as simple as a single egg, when it has required months of cleverness and care and cunning and deceit, a single egg can be symbolic of so much of the potential of these people and how they're taking care of each other. It's very stone soup in that way, you know? And that was really fun for me because I'm not a kind of Machiavellian, clever kind of guy. And so to create this character, I had to do a lot of work of thinking about what her network was. I literally had maps I had drawn on my desk just to keep track of all the people that she was meeting the needs of one way
right,
or another.
As she's sneaking around the village and finding back ways through the hedgerows to evade detection.
Part of her cunning is that she finds out where all these paths are so she can go behind all the German emplacements and get around without anyone seeing her. And it also means that she knows where the fuel is hidden and she knows where the machine gun nests are. And she has a mental map of where all of the troops are.
Emma spends every day exerting huge physical and mental effort to keep all of these people alive, to keep this whole network going. And she is watching occupiers kill her neighbors, rape her neighbors. And she is getting pressure from some people to join the official resistance. And she doesn't want to. She's so resistant to the resistance. Well, tell me why you positioned her in exactly that spot, that she was doing so much to keep things going, but was totally unwilling and uninterested in being in the resistance.
That's a really interesting question. There's a couple of pieces to the answer. I didn't want this to be predictable in terms of her politics. Her politics are politics of survival, right? It's a very divided world that she's in there. People that she loves are within the resistance and are killed and some before her eyes. But she's much more about how do we stay alive in these circumstances? How do we resist in our souls, in our persons, without necessarily picking up a gun? In fact, one of the challenges that she has that comes up multiple times in the book is she willing to kill a German? I'm not going to answer that on the air, but that's one of the dilemmas that she has is she willing to kill? And that's, you know, as she tries to keep her network alive, it would get a lot simpler if she could get a few people out of the way. So that becomes a temptation for her. I didn't want her to be somebody who was already pledged to kill anyone who stood in her way. I wanted her to have that moral dilemma because I think it's a huge one.
The role of faith and also religion are both really intertwined throughout the book. And hope is really the word that you keep coming back to.
Yes.
And Emma, especially, she scornfully at one point asks the priest, what does hope taste like? It's useless to her if she can't eat it.
That's right. Can it be traded for butter? She says, right.
So how did you envision the relationship between hope and faith in this village that is kind of teetering on the brink?
That is, it's enormous. It's an enormous part of the book. And I hope that most of it, there I am using the word, is subterranean. I'll say first that it can be a very dangerous thing to hope. One of the things that she learned is that when people want something, they will take risks and almost always it will fail. She's not going to admit that she has any wants because that creates a vulnerability. And she really believes that to have faith and to express your wants creates a kind of vulnerability. And that's a theme throughout the book. And her arc, in a large measure, is about recognizing in herself that she has this struggle within her about faith. And then, you know, there's a whole kind of literary deconstruction. Emmanuel is her full name, and that actually means God with us. And there is a whole relationship that she has with God. So there's a moment when she's addressing the priest about the war, and she says, you know, ask God why he forgot us. You know, how can God exist when the severity of war is all around? But that question of faith and hard times and how God can allow this kind of devastation is a thing to think about. In a time of violence and anti-Semitism and division and intolerance, perhaps the most defiant thing a people can do, whether it's today or 1944, is be kind to each other.
Throughout the book, the threat of sexual assault is present. The occupying soldiers raping civilian women.
Yes. I have to interrupt to say that every novel that I read, and I read a lot of books about this, many of the novels, in every case, the German captain who was billeted in the French person's home was gallant and polite and apologetic for the inconveniences, and that is complete and utter nonsense. And the history shows that sexual assault was a constant threat, was used as a part of the terrorism of war and to demoralize the local people. And one of the decisions I made very early on was that my captain was not going to be charming. And he was not going to be gallant. He was going to be a monster. But what that also meant was that I had the pleasure for the first time in my life in my fifth book of having a bad guy. I cannot tell you how much fun it is to have a little Darth Vader walking around your novel capable of doing horrible things with complete surprise. And sometimes he even really surprised me with how violent he could be and how zealous he was and fanatical in his Nazism. And but yes, I was not going to have good fellas who are just here for the dirty business of war, but were decent men. I wanted something that was a little grittier. And I did read the history, which is that just like any other major war, that sexual assault is part of the armaments
right.
of the invading army.
And so when you're trying to reveal that history, but you're also writing a novel that is dramatic and suspenseful and, you know, and it's heart entertaining, there can be an inadvertent way of writing it that's titillating. Is that a conversation that you had with editors or advanced readers? Like, how do you write these passages in a way that conveys the violence?
You know, I think one of the ways you do it is you take a major female character and you strap a knife to her leg under her dress so that something like that begin, she'll be armed. And there's another scene where we show what is beginning to look like it could be a sexual assault, and the scene turns out very, very differently. And again, shows how these people have enormous power, and certain characters have enormous power. And I think that there's a victory in that conquering that threat is an uplifting thing to see. And there's one sexual assault that does occur kind of off camera, and I think it's horrific, and I think that I couldn't be accurate to the history and leave it out, but I certainly don't believe that it's titillating. I think it should be terrifying, and it's, in my view, it is the darkest moment in the whole book.
And my impression as the reader is, in describing what was happening around the event and the aftermath of it without describing the event itself, it left that impression of it being horrifying.
It was why the
without actually describing what happened.
Exactly. The reader could imagine enough. And by seeing the repercussions, the reader can gauge what occurred. But it's also why the next chapter has to be the most uplifting moment, because I needed that balance for the reader. I don't want this to be a slog through a horrible war story. This is a story about triumph. This is a story about people in what is gritty and tough, and what it was like to live under occupation, but also to still have a will. And so the next chapter, I think, is almost comical in there's some comic moments for sure in how this community deals with a pig that never existed.
The village in The Baker's Secret is fictional, but you had a real place in mind when you placed your novel there. How much of this story is true? How much of it is based on known experiences?
Great question, I think. It starts with this. The book is historically accurate. I went to Normandy because, you know, some people are willing to suffer for their art.
Right,
obviously.
It's a tough gig.
Yeah. But I was willing to make that sacrifice. I'm a giver that way. And when I was over there, I found that the invasion had happened so fast, right? It was very fast. They left everything there. And the French response has been to continue to leave it there and just put a coat of paint on it every couple of years so it doesn't rust away. So you drive across a bridge and there'll be a machine gun pointed at you. You can go to Pointe du Hoc and there is an area, I don't know, bigger than a football field where there are still 40-foot deep bomb craters. It's all still there. And so I was in Normandy in part researching it and in part looking for a place where my town was. Which town was I going to set it in? And I went from town to town to town. I kept saying, no, not quite this, not quite that. I couldn't find the right spot. And then I went to a place called Longchamp, where the Germans had this enormous battlement with these guns. I can't tell you the gauge of them, but I know the barrels were 50 feet long. And they were in these concrete and steel pillboxes, basically concrete caves that were man-made with trees on top, and they were stuck in. Took 12 men to turn and fire these guns. They're massive, massive guns. And they were in a semicircle around this enormous wheat field, pointed at the ocean, and they had a shooting range of 12 miles, which is about as far as you can see before the curve of the earth. So they covered hundreds of miles of ocean. And these guns were so well hidden and so effective that they were still firing at 7 o'clock at night on D-Day. Very, very powerful. And when I went there, it was upsetting in a way that other places hadn't been, because I realized there was a kind of intelligence that human nature contains, that they could think of something like this, that we as a species could think of something as deadly as this. And, you know, I'm a believer in German engineering. I drive a German car, you know, but I think there was this kind of genius in it that was really heartbreaking. And I walked away from those guns and I walked out of the historic area and I walked a fair distance and I came to, when I sort of looked around myself, I was at an orchard, and I live near an orchard here in Vermont, and so I have sort of an eye for this, and I looked, and these trees were quite old, and they were very lovingly maintained. And I said, here is where my villagers will be, and they will not be militant people. They will be people who take care of their trees, and this kind of intelligence that created this weaponry will broil them alive. And so I created in my town, Verger, which is French for orchard. That's where my town came from.
Tell us a little bit about what your writing process was like. As you were walking around that orchard and across those battlements, were you already starting to write in your mind what this scene looks like, what these people will be?
You know, so much of it is vivid there. You know, if you go to Arromanches, there are still metal kind of bulwarks in the water where Churchill wanted to create an instant harbor. It's still there. And so I'm looking at the landscape and thinking, what are these people like? And, you know, if you take away the fact that the English Channel is there, it's very much northern Vermont, right? It's orchards, it's farming, it's much older, of course. The people have been there for thousands of years. But there was that kind of small community with open landscape, working landscape around it, that which the French have wisely conserved. And so I was imagining that. I didn't know the hedgerows would become a character in my book. I didn't know about that every town had a beautiful old church, which again is very Vermont, except instead of a steeple, they're made of stone. And I tried to imagine these people living there. And of course, I spoke with a lot of people there, and I speak French very badly. But I found that if I just made fun of how bad my French was and told them to ignore what tense I was speaking in, that they were good sports about it. So all this time, I'm saying, what's the story in this place? The setting is so vivid. The place is so vivid. What is the story of these people? And so I read a lot of diaries from that time, and most of them were resistance diaries. So I didn't go exactly with that, but you know, we know what rural people are like, and we love them. And as I say, these people cared for their trees. It was easy to care for them.
There have been so many beautiful novels in the last few years about the civilian experience of World War II. Kate Atkinson's books come to mind, mm-hmm. Life After Life and A God in Ruins.
Yes.
All the Light We Cannot See.
Yes.
What is happening in the literary ecosystem that so many beautiful novels from this time are coming about now, all these years later, decades later?
I think it's actually kind of a cultural commentary when you talk about these books as a group. And the ones you mentioned are lovely books, and I've read most of them, and there are others too that are really very good. And I think it is actually how the book world is responding to our current moment in the world, almost the opposite of Hollywood, right? Hollywood says, here comes a superhero with superpowers who will rescue us from the evil. And that is a fallacy, and it doesn't matter how many superhero movies you see, that is a fallacy. And so I think that the literary world is responding in a very different way. We're not giving anyone superpowers. These are very ordinary folk. There is almost a humility in that that says, hey, war is really, really personal, almost intimate. It's so personal, and there is no superhero. We need to save ourselves. And I actually think, you know, at sort of the meta level, I believe that the literary world is closer to the reality of the human experience than the superhero stories are, even though it would be nice if someone would save us all. I think we're going to have to save ourselves.
Stephen Kiernan is the author of The Baker's Secret. It's his third novel. Thank you so much for discussing it with me.
Happy to chat.